Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 5th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Crystals from a Molten Earth, presented by Ralph Dawes, number DAR 2005-01. Let's listen in.
Worked on some nearby rocks for my graduate study, as my wife Cheryl over there knows, since she was, among other jobs, my graduate student facilitator in the geology department. It kept me on track towards my degree while she worked on her bachelor's degree in geology. Let me just, the title of today's class, this is the first of five sessions I'm teaching in geology this week at Holden Village. So some of what I'd like to talk about is going to be held off, or what you might want to hear about, is mostly going to be held off until later sessions this week. Today it's called Crystals from a Molten Earth, which is about what are known as igneous rock, which make up a lot of these mountains around here. And the way I see today's class going, this session going, is it's going to start out with a lecture with an introduction and history and theory, and then we'll segue into more open, then we'll look at rocks, including some pictures I have to show a PowerPoint of rocks and discussion about rocks. So it'll kind of go from me lecturing, ease up as we go into more of a discussion and a workshop on rocks that you find around here. So, come in, Mike, and we're going next door. So let's see. So of course you can ask questions any time, but the second half will be more open discussion than the first half as far as what I have planned. So, come on in. I was just saying, the first part of this geology class is more lecture, and the second half is more discussion and looking at rocks and things. Okay, so, start up with the lecture. The part I wrote down first. The Earth holds us with its gravity, and this valley here enfolds us within its declivity, and these mountains, these tall peaks around us, inspire people to seek the high places, to look to a more distant horizon, to breathe the rarefied air, and such a journey proceeds one step at a time. And the theme this summer at Holden Village is take off your shoes. So when you look at, and at least in your imagination, and imagine walking around on these rocks in these mountains around here, what I think a lot of people experience is maybe a variety of things, a sense of beauty in these mountains, a sense of wonder, a sense of awe, a sense of vertigo, and a sense of curiosity. And so the curiosity is the main jumping off point for me for explaining the science of these rocks that are in the mountains around here. These are answers to questions driven by basic human curiosity. All the other aspects of what makes mountains work in terms of the human experience of them, I mean, some of that touches into geology, but some of it goes beyond. And we can talk about that too later. But let's take off your shoes. So we're going to start with what's underfoot, what's in the rocks. Almost a poem. Upon what trod? Feet unshod. It rhymes, so maybe we'll remember that. Alright. Now, taking the scientific approach to this. Well, let me make a little bit of a list of questions. Some of these. Today it's mainly what are these rocks, in particular what is this one class of rocks, some of you know what this means already, which is igneous rocks. How do they form? And then later this week, I'm going to plan on that in other sessions if you're here and want to come to them, why are these mountains here and not in Minnesota, say? How did this valley form as a landform, as a geomorphologic feature? and what's been happening to the climate, and also what will happen to this physical landscape in the future is where we'll end up on Friday. Now science, and what I'm trying to avoid, but any science teacher will find themselves slipping into this sometimes despite their best efforts, is to just, I don't want to just teach it as a sequence of received facts, because of course that's not really how science works. Science advances on three fronts, is one way of thinking about it. One is empirical science, based on observation, and there's a lot of that in geology, looking at the rocks, the fossils, the crystals, mapping out the relations that are out there. That's empirical science, one way of advancing science. Another way is experimental, and there's certainly a lot of that in geology, more than you might think. Especially when it comes to how rocks like this originate. People try to simulate and grow rocks like this in laboratories to see how it really works. And then there's theoretical, which is taking established facts or evidence and ideas and deducing further out from there other things on the basis of logic and reason and mathematics, if that works. So, let me write this down. There's empirical, experimental, and theoretical. Geology, because it seems like it focuses on rocks, has a somewhat unwarranted reputation for being all empirical and not enough of the others. Anyone who's a grad student in geology these days knows that's not true. Maybe to make up for that reputation, your nose is grounded in experimental theoretical if you're a geology student these days, more than it is looking at the rocks themselves. But nonetheless, the public may have that impression that it doesn't include much experiment in theory when it actually does. Because for an idea in science to become a successful theory, it has to succeed on all three fronts. The observations, the experiments, and the theoretical deductions, the reasoning based on all that, the model that's developed, it all has to click together. They all have to be consistent with each other and support each other, or it's not going to become a successful theory in science, in the form of modern science. Now, some of these rocks are useful for taking us back in the history of geology as a science 200 to 250 years ago, mid to late 1700s, when the United States first became a country, and modern science was becoming what it is, you know, was forming itself into what we call modern science, out of what they call the Enlightenment, if they still use that term. Astronomy had already pretty much shaken itself free. I mean, Copernicus was 150 years before then. So astronomy had already pretty much shaken itself free from the non-science we call astrology. But in the late 1700s, chemistry was still pretty much alchemy. It wasn't until the early 1800s that they started identifying elements and establishing the modern atomic theory in chemistry. Physics with Newton had come and gone, so physics was well on its way because the Newtonian Revolution had occurred, and so physics was helping lead the way into modern science. And geology was also there as part of the mix in the late 1700s, in its infancy, but nonetheless becoming established as a science that proceeds on the basis of those three ways. And there was a professor, but science also proceeds on the basis of personality and the influence that people have on each other. And there was a professor in Germany at the time, I didn't read my notes, I'm sure I couldn't remember his first name, but his last name was Werner, W-E-R-N-E-R, who was tremendously influential and powerful and brilliant and successful as a geology professor in the early days of geology. He got a start in the mines of Saxony in Germany, and he gave lectures. Don't have my notes, so I don't remember which university. But it was almost like to be a successful geologist at the time, at least in academic circles, you had to have been a student of Werner's in the late 1700s. And one of his main theories, well, let me back up a step. Okay, geology is getting started as a science. It wants to explain the Earth and what's in the Earth and what the Earth is made of. Two of the most common types of rock are basalt, this black fine-grained rock, and granite, rocks like, well, loosely speaking, we can call them all granite, rocks like this. So for geology to succeed, it had to be able to explain basalt and granite, among other things. Werner explained them with a theory or a school of thought that's now called Neptunism. which is the idea that the early Earth was covered by a deep primeval ocean. Let me write this down. So you see where Neptune, the god of the sea, has the supplies. So here's the early Earth, and it's covered by, this is a very simplified drawing, covered by a primeval ocean, which slowly evaporated and went away, leaving behind a little bit of water we now call the oceans today. And according to Werner, according to this Neptunism school of thought, rocks like granite and basalt were salts that crystallized at the bottom of the primeval ocean and are left over from early in the Earth's history. And that was the dominant theory for a few years, a few decades, in the late 1700s in Europe, in the academic circles. So that was the explanation for basalt and granite. Well, Werner's own students went out from Germany and down to central France and Italy, where volcanoes actually erupt, and saw that basalt comes from lava. It's volcanic. So, a good professor produces students that go beyond what he or she did. So they showed that he was wrong about basalt. It's not a, notice the name, basalt. It was thought to be a basic salt of the ancient ocean. It still shows up in the name. But his own students showed that he was wrong about that. It comes from molten rock that solidifies on the face of the earth. Well, that leaves granite, which is a little more mysterious as to how it originates. But a man in Scotland, a Scotsman named James Hutton, published a book in 1795, a very poorly written book. I've only read parts of it myself because it's hard to read, even though it's in English, called A Theory of the Earth. And among other things, he argued that granite is also an igneous rock, rock that comes from molten rock inside the earth that ends up turning into a solid rock as it cools and solidifies. Only granite is different from basalt because instead of coming out as a lava flow, the molten rock stays down inside the earth and crystallizes, turns into all these different crystals and turns solid down there inside the earth. This idea of Hutton's is called Plutonism, after Pluto, the god of the underworld. So here's the surface of the earth. Here's a crack out of which some lava flowed and formed some basalt, say, on the Earth's surface. But down underneath the Earth's surface, down in the crust, is a batch of molten rock that when it turns solid, there's your granite. So those were the two competing theories, and Hutton started out as the trailing candidate for who had the successful idea, because most of the influential geologists in Europe at the time subscribed to Werner. But in the end, the observations and the experiments, although some of the experiments weren't really done until the 20th century, and the theory all clicked together and ended up supporting Plutonism, and it's long since become the established theory for the origin of granite in geology. However, it's a theory. No one's ever been down inside the earth and watched granite crystallized. You can, to some extent, do it in the laboratory. They have these piston cylinder with heaters and laser beam apparatus, they can make and crystallize a mock-up granite in the laboratory. But you don't have thousands or millions of years to grow crystals exactly the same size. You only extrapolate from what you see and do a few calculations. Say, given this much time, the crystals would be this big. The chemistry works, the temperatures work, et cetera, et cetera. There's certainly no one's going back to the Neptunism school. These are not salts that crystallize out of water at the bottom of the ocean. But the reason I bring up how it's the theory, even though there's all this evidence and experiments and observation in its favor, well, that's what makes a theory. It's a successful idea. But in the 20th century, there was an alternative school of thought for a while that never became a majority, but it was called the granitizer school of thought, which is that granites form by, kind of as a metamorphic rock, by recrystallization of existing rock due to fluids percolating through them, not molten rock, but water-rich fluids percolating through them inside the earth. So it went against the Plutonism, molten rock origin school. And I've encountered, there's still some geologists around that were trained in the granitizer idea. Actually, University of Washington was one of the main outposts of that for a while, back in the 1930s to 1950s. But again, they were if you're going to add up objectively, I think, the empirical, experimental, and theoretical evidence, it doesn't work. It's back to a molten rock origin for granite. So most universities, you won't hear of this granitizer theory. But having been to the University of Washington when some of the old-timers were still around, I was exposed to that. I was reminded what a theory is. No one's, you know, it's an idea for which there's a wealth of evidence. It's convincing and it's good, but it can be questioned, and there may be alternative ideas that are worth checking out. Although basalt, people have seen basalt form on the Earth's surface. That one, I don't think anyone's going to doubt. It's just when you go down inside the Earth below the surface, where you can't go in person, that it becomes more what some people mean by theoretical, where it has to be based on indirect evidence. Okay, one other idea of Hutton's, and you know, history has sort of rewritten it and relabeled it. He didn't necessarily put it exactly this way in his original book, but this is the way it's portrayed in textbooks now, is the rock cycle. And by the way, if I had time, I'd go into a bunch of evidence. I have a little bit in some of these pictures, but not much. I'll show you pictures later. Evidence for how granite is from intrusions of molten rock inside the Earth, and experiments and all that, but most of you just take my word for it today. But anyway, the rock cycle. I would encourage you, if you're out hiking around looking at granites, think about what evidence you can see that's consistent with them forming as intrusions of molten rock inside the Earth, or not consistent. The rock cycle is one of Hutton's other big ideas, and that's he put the geological Earth together in his mind as a bunch of processes that all connect together, rather than a bunch of rocks that have just sat there forever. It's a process, not just a static thing in Hutton's view, and that's become, again, this has become verified and accepted as a basic idea that's still in geology. Now, you can start the rock cycle anywhere, but the standard beginning point is magma or molten rock inside the Earth. When the molten rock cools and solidifies, like it turns into a bunch of minerals, if you want later I can try to go over the difference between a rock and a mineral, but this rock is made of a bunch of minerals. Anyway, it turns solid, that molten rock. And you have, this is just a name, but it's igneous rock. So igneous rock is one of your main categories of rock. It forms from molten rock inside the Earth, which is technically known as magma. And then it erupts. Igneous rock, look back to this later, there's volcanic igneous rock and there's the other kind. But let's go on. Igneous rock exposed at the Earth's surface to the elements, to gravity, to air, to water, undergoes weathering. I think it's worth for me to write down these processes, because to Hutton, it was processes that were just as important as the verbs were just as important as the nouns in the cycle. Weathering, erosion, and then that loose material that broke down from these rocks and got washed down the streams and blown out in the wind and so on, ends up piling up somewhere else, getting deposited, or deposition occurs. And then you have sediments. And now you're up where we live, on the Earth's surface, of course, going from here to here and all the sediments. But if the sediments get buried and compressed and some cementing minerals form in between the sediment grains, you have, of course, sedimentary rock. And if something causes even deeper burial or greater heat or greater pressure, the original sediment grains are going to change into new minerals. It's going to recrystallize into a new rock. Not by melting, but by chemical processes and chemical reactions that turn it into a new rock. So, hang on, I'm going to label this burial, compaction, lithification of sediments in the sedimentary rock can be summarized as a process of burial, compaction, and cementation. And back in the days of Hutton, was kind of, this was mostly new, partly new ideas, and the whole sequence was a new idea. Anyway, burial, heat, pressure, and possibly the introduction of hot water fluids down inside the earth to bring in some new dissolved chemical species. I'll leave that one out. It could be important, but we move on. That's, you have metamorphic rock. Oh, let me write this down. Recrystallization. And you have metamorphic rock. Which is Greek for changed form. It's become a new rock, replacing the old form. Further heat can produce melting. And then you're back to magma, molten rock, and start the cycle over. Any rock, whether it's sedimentary, metamorphic, or igneous, can undergo weathering and erosion and so on, and turn into sediment. And igneous rocks that form down inside the earth, like a granite, may stay down there and get metamorphosed. Oops, in here. So it's not just a cycle, it's more of a concept map. All right, that's Hutton's big idea. Now, or one of his big ideas. Okay. And, all right. Yeah, so here, in the heart of the North Cascades, the geologists call this larger area, that this is just part of the crystalline core of the North Cascades, because most of the rocks have sparkly and visible crystals in them. Anyway, in this area, we can see lots of metamorphic rock and lots of igneous rock of a certain type. But we don't find sedimentary rock around here. Now, does anybody know why that is? Why do we have to go back out to Wenatchee or over to Seattle to find sedimentary rock in the area?
This is originally a volcanic area. This really wasn't sea bottom that it would take to be sedimentary.
Well, yes and no. But if it was if it was volcanic, what happened to the volcanoes?
Weathered.
Weathered and eroded.
Right.
And that's because the crust in this area has undergone a huge amount of uplift, and the upper layers have eroded away. The sedimentary rocks are only found in the upper crust. This area is missing the upper crust. There's been so much uplift in the building of these mountains that the upper layers, which include the sedimentary rocks, have been stripped away by erosion, and you're down into the deeper layers that form down inside the earth, which is metamorphic rocks and that one group of igneous rocks, that, like granite, that form down deep in the crust. Okay. So from Earth, even in the late, as far as geologists in this actual area, in the North Cascades, the first ones in here were in the very late 1800s, they knew from the beginning, once they were in here, that this was deep crust that had been exposed, and the surface, the upper layers had been eroded away, which is how mountain ranges work in a lot of areas. If you're not uplift and erosion goes on, you're down into the deep layers of the crust that have been brought up and exposed by erosion. So, I always do that.
Pen up here.
Because it requires heat and usually some pressure and possibly some hot water fluids, metamorphic rocks form at some depth, usually quite a bit of depth, down in the crust. You can find those around here. In fact, that's what they mine over here. Those are metamorphic rocks at the Holden mine, and pretty much underneath here, under our feet. But then there's also igneous rocks. Of the type called plutonic. And then if you go over to Glacier Peak, yeah, there's a volcano there that's formed. Recently, Glacier Peak has built up a pile of volcanic rocks on top of these old rocks from deeper in the crust that were already exposed in the area. So you get some volcanic rocks in the North Cascades where the volcanoes are, of course. But the rest, around two-thirds of the volume, I don't know the exact number, of the North Cascades, two-thirds of the area you walk across, hiking up to Cloudy Pass and so on, is plutonic igneous rock. rock-like granite and its relatives that are thought to have crystallized, solidified into these mineral crystals. And that's all the rock is made of, is those minerals, down relatively deep inside the earth. Okay, any questions? So, I hope you didn't mind me laboring through that. I could have just told you it's granite and formed that deep down, or it's granite and its relatives, plutonic rocks, etc. But I wanted to run through how that's the theory, and the theory goes back a few hundred years. And that's how science works. So, and what I want to do next, pending any questions, is look at some of these rocks and talk about what they are in terms of names and also how they're thought to form in terms of theory. Okay? We have to what, 4:45? We're doing that next time. So, let's see. I have a slideshow. Maybe I'll do the slideshow first and then we'll look at the real rocks. This is yesterday, Cheryl, my wife, and I went on a hike up to Heart Lake. Got a few pictures and a few rocks. And this is just some pictures we brought back. So if you're on a hike, you may already know some of these rocks, or this will help verify what you know, or maybe you don't know the names of them yet. This will help you learn. Alright, there it is. Alright, on our way up Railroad Creek Valley, after a while we got a view up past Heart Lake. This is with a 10-power telephoto zoom lens, and this is actually looking all the way up above Lyman Lake from down below Heart Lake. And does anyone know, is that cloudy peak up there? It's cloudy pass to the left, just a little bit off the picture, I think.
That's North Star.
That's North Star?
Yeah.
Okay, so I should have done some more. I wish I had time to get out there more. Because here's what I am sure of, which is that the lighter colored rock in here is a huge batch of granite and similar rocks, plutonic rock that formed down inside the earth. And it's called, of all things, the Cloudy Pass Batholith. Batholith is a word for a huge, or relatively large body of granite or similar rocks that form this way. So this is a Cloudy Pass Batholith, but the dark top up here may be a different rock. In fact, I wish we didn't have any time to get close to this in the time we had. And I was trying to correlate this with the geologic map. So what is it, North Star?
Yeah.
I'll take another look at the geologic map when I get a chance. Because this may be a different rock type up above, but the molten rock intruded up underneath. There's some alternatives. This could be a later bit of shallow volcanic rock that forces me in on top of the cloudy pass batholith. Of course, in reality, you can't do this from a distance. We'd have to go up there and check it out up close. But once from Heart Lake beyond, you're in the cloudy pass batholith. From there, over cloudy pass, up to Lyman Lake, the bedrock is this stuff. So we just got into this a little bit up at Heart Lake. And we have some pieces out here. Let me pass those out next. Here's some pieces of the cloudy pass batholith. Let me pass these around the room. Common granitic rock. These would either be granite or granite diorite. I'd have to do some staining and microscope work to know for sure. It's a mixture of common minerals. And it's garden variety, one of the most common types of rocks in the crust. And it's taken 200 years of geological struggle to be sure of how these things originate. Because they originate a little ways down inside the earth. Okay.
What sort of elements comprise?
You mean chemical elements? Like,
yeah.
Mostly silica and oxygen. Silica, almost all the minerals in there are silicate minerals. The two most abundant element types in there are actually number one, oxygen, but it's all combined with silicon to form the silicate minerals. So it goes oxygen, silicon, probably sodium and potassium, and iron and a little bit of magnesium, not that much, and calcium, did I mention that? That makes up already over 90% of that rock.
I think it would be helpful to identify the major minerals in that rock.
Ah, well, okay, the white mineral is sodium plagioclase, It's of this group of minerals known as feldspar, which are actually more common, more abundant in the Earth's crust than quartz is. The clear mineral in there is quartz. Here's a magnifying lens to do. I'm going to hold it up real close to your eye. I think the light in here is very good for that.
You can. There's a switch over here. I'll go pick up these.
Okay, and actually, now I know from teaching geology 101 classes, students tend to think the white mineral is quartz when it's actually plagioclase. Quartz is a little bit harder to see because it's just these little clear blobs in there. They're mostly round in shape. And the black mineral in that one is biotite. It's a mica, platy, flaky mineral, very common. So that's a biotite granodiorite. Just saying the word granodiorite means it has the white plagioclase, a little bit of this other feldspar. It's harder to see in there, quartz, and so on. One of the most common rocks in the whole Earth's crust. And there's an example of it up at Cloudy Pass area. All right, looking from Heart Lake, again, this is zoomed in a little bit. We're pretty sure, even though to be a good geologist, we should have scrambled up there and verified. But sitting down at our picnic at Heart Lake and zooming in with the telephone, we think this is the Cloudy Pass batholith here, and this is the contact, as geologists call it, between it and another body of rock here known as the Dumbbell Mountain Pluton, which is also a form of granite, or it was a form of granite, with more black minerals in it, so it's actually more of a diorite and granodiorite over here. And this other type of rock, relative of granite, known as tonaline. It's a mixture, it varies, but it's certainly darker. And it also happens to be older, and it's somewhat metamorphosed. It's been around in the Earth's crust long enough, the Dumbbell Mountain Pluton, that it really, even though geologists tend to call it like it's an igneous rock, it's actually somewhat metamorphosed, squeezed and slightly recrystallized. So this is an older rock, and this is a younger rock, and here's the contact between them. Now, if what I'm saying is true, if we went up to this contact, we should be able to see that this batholithic rock here turns into finer grained crystals along the edge because it was cooler there and it crystallized quicker there, and that makes the minerals, it doesn't give the minerals much time to grow, so it gets a finer grained aspect to it. We would also see signs of heating affecting the older rock next door. And there's other things you can look for to show that this is the younger intrusion that intruded against this older pre-existing rock. And these are the kind of things that Hutton would point out, saying, look, this is not basalt from the bottom of the ocean. This is this massive hot molten rock that intruded its way in the pre-existing rock inside the Earth's crust. Okay. Now, I should put volcanic in quotation marks here. This is just a boulder that rolled down from the mountainside along the trail. But here's more of a relative of granite, perhaps a granodiorite or a tonalite. And since it rolled down the hill, you can't do too much bedrock geology out of it. I'm not sure if it's part of the Dumbbell Mountain Pluton, the older, slightly metamorphosed one. But it's a common rock in the North Cascades. But this is what's known as a dike, also full of igneous rock, much finer grain, that came in and filled a crack up, or wedged its way through and forced a crack to open in the pre-existing rock, and then cooled and solidified in here. It doesn't show up very well on the picture like you can see out there, but the edge of this dike does turn finer grain against the rock it intruded because it was cooler there, so this molten magma, molten material cooled quickly here against the cooler adjacent rock. And there's a bit of a flow banding. In other words, this was flowing molten rock that was moving in some direction through this crack, and it makes it a little, you can sort of see that in the way the minerals line up along the edge. Again, this is more of Hutton's types of evidence for how these were molten rock from inside the earth, not salts crystallizing at the bottom of the ocean. This is actually an intrusive or plutonic rock, but it looks like a volcanic rock. It just about looks like a basalt. because it's so fine-grained, this must be, I would think this must be a much younger intrusion that came up in very shallow crust where the rocks around it were so cold it was almost like it erupted to the Earth's surface and cooled quickly and looks like a volcanic rock. Those are called hypabyssal or very shallow plutonic rocks, and they're given the same names as for rock types as igneous rock. You call this a basalt. Even though I'm sure it is a little ways down, it ended up looking like a basalt because it cooled so quickly. So, short of going over to Glacier Peak and finding some lava flows that have solidified over there, this is the closest you get right around Holden to something we could pretend is a volcanic rock. It came up closer to the surface and cooled quickly. The nearest actual volcanic rocks, though, are over at Glacier Peak, past Cloudy Pass and on down across the Swallow River. We didn't make it that far on a little hike yesterday, so I didn't get any Glacier Peak pictures. It was probably in the clouds anyway. Moving on. Okay, well, then back to this take your shoes off theme. The rocks they put in the footpaths here in Holden Village come from right in the area, of course. They're not going to haul them in from far away if they don't need to. And, well, some of these are metamorphic rocks, which is more for tomorrow and Wednesday for those that are still around. And I want to hear about the metamorphic rocks. But here's one of those relatives of granite, one of those plutonic rocks that formed as a big batch of molten magma inside the earth. Here's another one of those rocks from a shallow dike passing as a volcanic rock. This one would probably be the type of rock called an andesite. I can tell that from the white feldspar crystals, white plagioclase feldspar crystals in it, and the intermediate gray color. Basalt's the more black one, andesite's the more gray one. This one is porphyritic. It has a bunch of visible crystals speckling its surface, but the rest of the rock is fine-grained from quick cooling. And you can verify this also with microscopic work, which you don't see right here. And then some more plutonic igneous rocks in the footpaths around here. This is stuff from the hillside and also from what they pulled out of what washed down the river, probably. Or it could have been carried in by a little glacier. All right, so again, this one is more of a diorite, another relative of granite. That makes up at least half of the mountains around here. So, you know, when you're hiking around, you can see a lot of this stuff. And now, compare this to the next picture. It almost looks like the previous one, but the minerals are oriented in this one. So that's called, it's either lineated or if it forms sort of layers, it's called foliated. So this raises the question, is this a plutonic igneous rock? Or is this a metamorphic rock? Because plutonic igneous rocks, that batch of molten magma forces its way into the crust, and then it sits there, and without much further flow, except maybe along the edge of the magma body, it just sits there and crystallizes, and the crystals go every which way randomly. It doesn't have an oriented structure to the minerals, or a preferred orientation to the minerals, in your standard granite, like that one I passed around earlier, in Cloudy Pass Basalt. But these are, you know, due to the statistics, the long axes of these minerals are pretty strongly oriented this way. All right, well, there's this is a problem that's, maybe it's a semantic argument, but it's not just a semantic argument, it also gets to the theory of how these rocks form. Is it possible that magma intrudes into crust that's undergoing some major faulting? And so you get a body of molten magma in a zone of the crust that's under a lot of stress, and the rocks, the solid rock on the other side is maybe offsetting like this. And then as it starts to form solid crystals, it goes from liquid to solid step by step, not all at once. So it's partly a crystal liquid mush. Could that shear stress or some other form of stress on the magma body orient the crystals while there's still some magma present? In which case, it's an igneous rock, not a metamorphic rock. Or did it turn solid and then later it got stressed by tectonic forces in the crust, like a major fault zone, and recrystallized into new shapes of crystals, pretty much the same minerals, because it was still at high temperature and high pressure down in the crust, but it recrystallized into new shapes to accommodate the stress. If the latter is the case, then we call that a metamorphic rock, if these crystals grew in place of the old form of the crystals into these preferred orientations without any molten rock present, that's metamorphic. If the minerals took on these orientations when there was still, when this was still crystallizing from a magma and there was still some molten rock present in the mix, then this is igneous. You see rocks like this a lot in the North Cascades. They're these foliated granites, or these, if it's a metamorphic rock, there's another name for it, a German name, which is gneiss, G-N-E-I-S-S. And you would need to work with a microscope and really study it to decide if this was entirely igneous in origin, or if it recrystallized. It started out as a granite or a diorite or a granodiorite, one of those granite rocks, and then later got metamorphosed and recrystallized into this, these oriented layers. Now I labor this point a little bit, perhaps because I worked on rocks like this in the North Cascades. I spent a lot of time arguing with other geologists as to whether this was an igneous, and my wife, whether this was an igneous rock, well, discussing I should say, or a metamorphic rock. Because it can be important in how you interpret how this rock fits into the formation of the North Cascades, what the faults and the tectonics were doing at the time, and all that stuff. And, all right, another, this is that andesite. It's actually an intrusive or plutonic rock, but shallow in the crust, so it ends up looking like a volcanic rock, and has a volcanic rock name, andesite. Again, porphyritic, mostly fine-grained, but with some visible crystals speckled in it. Those crystals formed before it finished intruding and quickly crystallizing into the fine-grained part. The idea. Oops, I went too far. Missed one on this. And finally, the somewhat vague and weathered footpath rock. It's got some weathering, some dirt on it, so it's hard to see, but it's a diorite or a tonalite, one of those granite relatives. And then there's this dark area, okay? That, and you'll see a lot of rocks like this around here in the North Cascades, too. This is, the word mafic is what you give to the darker types of rock like this, because they have more iron and magnesium, which, without going into it, leads to the word mafic. Now, historically in geology, these are usually called xenoliths, which is fine, and they've usually been interpreted as, okay, you get this Earth's solid crust, but a batch of molten rock somehow forces its way up and becomes a new plutonic batholith or whatever. Chunks of the pre-existing solid crust could fall into it, get enveloped by it, get surrounded by the molten material, and end up frozen inside it as it turns solid. And that's fine. A lot of xenoliths originate that way. You can connect them up with the wall rock beyond the igneous rock. The solid pre-existing rock that got intruded. But a lot of them don't, and when you look at them, they turn out to be igneous rocks too, that suggest that there was more than one type of magma, with more than one type of chemistry that was involved in creating these granite and diorite and so on. Batholiths in the North Cascades, all this kind of stuff I worked on in my graduate research. And what we found was that even deeper than the Earth's crust is the Earth's mantle. Coming up out of the mantle were these mafic magmas with lots of iron and magnesium in them, along with silicon and oxygen and calcium and so on. All that heat, and these are hotter magmas coming out of the hotter mantle down below. All that heat would lead to some melting of the crust that got intruded down deep in the crust, and that would form a much lighter colored melt, kind of like this granite from the Cloudy Pass Batholith. And to some extent, the two would mix and mingle together, forming rocks darker than this, but lighter than this, like this, as a result of the mixing. So if you look around, you might find yourself out hiking in the North Cascades, and you might start seeing a lot of this stuff. And if you look at these dark areas, you'll see how they swirl and grade into, in some cases, the rest of the rock. There may have been a dark magma mixing and interacting with a lighter colored magma as part of that process. Okay. Well, this is not a great example, but like this rock right here, it has a dark area and then it has a lighter colored area. It's got a variety of composition, but it's basically a relative of granite that apparently formed as a plutonic igneous rock. And then, just here are these are, I'm pretty sure these rocks are metamorphic. These, this much layering and lineation of the minerals doesn't happen within the molten state. These minerals are too broken up and stretched out and so on. And so these are no longer igneous, these are metamorphic. But I think they started out as igneous rocks, plutonic igneous rocks, granite and diorite and so on. So you'll see lots of these rocks in the Cascades as well. If you want to look at any of these dike rocks that are passing as volcanic rocks, even though they're from shallow intrusions, here's one that's kind of basaltic, perhaps, and one that's perhaps an andesite. So I've used up 3/4 of my time. The point being that the North Cascades reveal rocks that form deep inside the crust. These mountains are undergoing rapid uplift and erosion, and it's already gotten down into the middle levels of the crust. So you're not going to find sedimentary rocks here in the middle of the Cascades. You're going to find plutonic igneous rocks, like these granites and diorites, and metamorphic rocks. They got heated and squeezed. And the theory for how these igneous rocks, these plutonic rocks, formed, it didn't just get written down in a book and that was it. It was a number of years of controversy and looking at the evidence and running the experiments. And in the details, there's still some arguing over just which kind of magma and where did it come from and what the chemical sequence was for how these rocks formed. But the general idea is pretty well accepted as an established theory. The Plutonism school of thought is what we're looking at. So, questions? And if you have any other questions about the geology of the North Cascades and the rocks around here, especially if you're not going to be back in future sessions of mine this week, where I might cover some of these other topics. If you have any other questions about other topics, this is also a good time to bring them up. Yeah.
Last time I was here, about 8 or 9 years ago, we found a piece of marble.
Yeah.
Is this a terrain feature, do you think?
It is a terrain feature.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it's thought to be. Okay, I've been running you through all these plutonic igneous rocks and a little bit of dike rocks, which are also igneous. But right here at Holden, we're in metamorphic rock.
Right.
And looking now metamorphism, where the rocks get heated and pressurized and new chemicals come in, dissolved in water, and it turns into a new rock, that partly masks and obscures what the rocks used to be, and where the type of rock they used to be. But nonetheless, the rocks around Holden used to be layers of rock that overall trace back to, it looks like they came from the floor of the ocean. Part of them may have been basalts, which is a main rock type that forms the solid ocean floor. And also, as you know, on the floor of the ocean is where limestone forms, and that's under metamorphism, limestone turns into marble, or other carbonates like limestone turn into marble. And those just about, most of those form on the floor of the ocean. And they can trace layers of marble around for up to a couple miles in the hillsides up above, like up on Copper Mountain and Buckskin Mountain here. So they look at the whole sequence and they go, well, okay, we had oceanic crust. Later, the oceanic crust may have had other things happen to it, but it started out as oceanic crust. And oceanic crust initially starts out as mostly basalt in the upper layers. If basalt gets metamorphosed, it turns into this dark metamorphic rock. At certain conditions, it'll be what's called amphibolite, with a lot of black hornblende mineral in it. There's some of that around here. But if it's sedimentary rock from the ocean floor, the ocean floor is where sediments accumulate too, there's a lot of types of sediment. One of them is carbonate sediments like coral reefs, or just there's other ways that limestone forms besides coral reefs, but most of it happens on the ocean floor. So that would get metamorphosed into marble. Anyway, so there's amphibolite, there's marble, there's quartz, muscovite, schist around here, which would have been like a sandstone or siltstone. Well, probably a siltstone or even a mudstone from the ocean floor. They see all these together in sequence, and it only makes sense that originally it was some ocean floor environment. And I don't, you know, a lot has happened to it since then. But part of that, you know, looking at the geologic map, yeah, there's some layers of marble around here. It's part of that sequence. And then there's the mine itself, which is in a copper and other metals deposit, which is thought to have originated also on, or just on, partly on the ocean floor. Have you ever seen any of those videos of those little research submarines that take you down into the deep ocean where it's dark, and they discovered those hot springs on the ocean floor starting in the late 1970s? Mm-hmm. And there's like black smokers where all the minerals come out and solidify and settle out of the water. That's kind of like how they think the copper deposit here at Holden formed in the first place. It's related to volcanism, but it's just circulation of a lot of hot water that gets a lot of minerals and metals dissolved in it. And when that hot water comes back out of the hot crust through a hot spring on the ocean floor into the cold ocean water, the dissolved stuff turns into solid minerals and settles out on the ocean floor, forming, one thing it can form if a lot of it piles up is a massive sulfide deposit. And then anyone planning on coming back tomorrow or Wednesday for any classes? I can talk more about this, because some of this I'll cover Wednesday when we go over to the mine. But, all right, we're switching. We're leaving behind these plutonic igneous rocks. We're switching over to the metamorphic rocks over here at Holden that got intruded by the plutonic rocks. But the minerals in the mine over here, they have copper in them. The main one, I think, is copper pyrite. There's pyrite and some other minerals. A lot of these are sulfide minerals. And a lot of those black smokers on the ocean floor, a lot of that black stuff is sulfide minerals forming on the ocean floor. So if you get a really thick pile of sulfide minerals surrounded by, even if it's all metamorphosed and it's a little bit obscure as to what it originally was, if you get rocks that would only make sense if they form as a sequence on the bottom of the ocean, and then in the midst of that mix, you find a big lens or discontinuous layer or area of sulfide minerals. They have a lot of copper and a little bit of silver and zinc and gold in them. It probably was one of these volcanic-related ocean floor, hot spring on the ocean floor, black smoker, et cetera, deposit that formed a massive pile of sulfide there. Since then, and this is tomorrow's topic, but it looks like there'll be new people tomorrow, so I'll do this today. Some of you have heard of this. The North Cascades, how is it the parts of the ocean floor are now, having been cooked and squeezed and shoved around, here as part of the North Cascades. There wasn't a good theory for that until the 1960s with what's called plate tectonic theory, which is that the Earth's outer layer, the lithosphere, is moving around in the form of giant plates. They form the outer layer of the Earth. And where plates come together and converge on each other, that's where a whole bunch of stuff goes on that we spend a lot of time talking about. But one thing that can happen is if one plate's coming in with an ocean over it, and it's going down beneath another plate next door, and maybe the one next door has a continent on it. The process of this one going down into the other is called subduction. But leaving that aside, just staying up near the top, up in the crust, pieces of the ocean floor can get, to put it non-technically, scraped off onto the upper plate, accreted or added to the edge of it. And it's not a simple thing. They get shoved, they get faulted, they get squeezed, they get buried, they get metamorphosed, they get folded, they get tilted. And in the end, you get what you have around Holden, a body of rocks that don't really belong here as far as where they started out, came out from somewhere else, came in on a moving plate, according to this theory, and got added at a convergent plate boundary, where one plate met up with another, and one plate went under the other and left some of itself behind on the other plate. And that's typical of major mountain ranges like the Cascades. There's several others like that in the world today, and then going back in geologic history, there's other no longer active examples. So the Holden mine and the metamorphic rocks around Holden are thought to be part of an accreted terrain that originated out in the ocean somewhere else and came in on a moving plate. And, the Pacific Northwest today is still a subduction zone, causing volcanoes to erupt, causing earthquakes to happen. The center of action and the subduction zone itself has moved further west as time has gone by and more rocks have accreted to the edge of North America. Because the rocks around Holden were added and accreted to North America by something like roughly, according to the ages in the rocks,
100 million years ago. And a little bit of further metamorphism since then, but mostly just a long sequence of finally uplifting and eroding the stuff off the top to where the prospector can find the copper from the rocks from deeper in the crust if he or she looks around carefully. And that covers the rocks you're going to see around here, the metamorphic rocks of what used to be parts of the ocean floor. There's other places in the North Cascades, not far from here, where the metamorphic rocks are from other environments besides the floor of the ocean. Some of them may have been volcanoes out in the ocean, and some of it may have been near the edge of the continent where some sediments were coming out from the continent. And you get some slightly different types of sedimentary rock and volcanic rock. But since then, they've also been partly buried, shoved in, metamorphosed, faulted, intruded by these plutonic rocks. And so I added all up to see it came from elsewhere. It moved in. You got your burial, your metamorphism, your intrusion, and then slicing and dicing along faults. But nonetheless, we can, going back to the rock cycle, what you have around Holden is metamorphic rocks that are thought to be parts of accreted terrain, and plutonic rocks like this, some of which intruded before when it was out in the ocean and they're part of the accreted terrain, most of which may have intruded since the rest of the terrain got to North America and became part of this convergent plate boundary. Okay? Yeah.
Any idea what the plates are made of?
Well,
and what's underneath the plates?
Yeah. The plates are made of rock that, the plates consist of the Earth's crust in the top part of the plate. The deeper part of the plate is the upper mantle, which consists, and out of some volcanoes and in some major fault zones, we can see pieces of the upper mantle that are brought up to the surface. And that rock is even more than mafic. It's got lots of iron and magnesium in it. It's quite dense, which is why it's down deeper than the crust. But it's also a rock made out of mostly silicate minerals. The plates are, they vary in thickness, but they're on the order of 100 kilometers or 60 miles or so thick, which is thick, but, compared to the whole thing, so the Earth is really not that thick. So we have a pretty good handle on what the plates are made out of, and then underneath the plates is what's called the asthenosphere, also part of the upper mantle, but a little bit deeper. And asthenos, we're told, is a Greek word for weak or soft. The asthenosphere, because of the pressures, well, more importantly, because of the temperatures down there, it's soft. It's basically a solid. It's still mostly solid rock, but it's softer and, to be non-technical, squishier down there. So you get the relatively rigid solid plates on top, roughly 60 miles thick, and then you get a layer up to a couple hundred miles thick below that consists of soft, squishy stuff that could even flow around, sort of like taffy or something, slowly, the asthenosphere. And it's thought that the asthenosphere does flow and move, convect, move around like bringing up heat, releasing heat, spreading out, sinking back in, as part of the plate. There's a connection, but it's not exactly a one-to-one connection, between apparently the flowing asthenosphere and the plates on top moving around, partly in consort, or not completely in lockstep, but largely in step with the flow of the asthenosphere underneath. And then down deeper, it turns into solid, harder rock again, but then you're getting, it's totally theoretical at that point based on things like how earthquake waves move through it and so on to the deeper mantle. I just want to mention all these igneous rocks that I was talking about, whether they're volcanic or whether they're plutonic, they come from melting in the relatively shallow earth compared to the whole earth. There's no connection in terms of molten material coming all the way up from the core, which is thought to be made mostly of iron and so on. There are only, so there's certain places in the Earth's crust and upper mantle where melting of rocks does occur, but it doesn't get more than on the order of 100 miles or so deep for the most part to get these magmas to originate. They don't come from all that deep compared to the whole Earth. So I say that because a lot of people who haven't taken more than one geology class or haven't yet taken a geology class imagine the connection between like the liquid outer core of the Earth and the volcanoes on the top. That's not the way. There's more in between than that, and it's not a direct connection. So again, if you're out hiking around, you got your plutonic rocks, you got your things that used to be plutonic rocks, but now they're all stretched out into lines and layers, so they may be metamorphosed. because of all the pushing and stressing and faulting of the crust in the area. And then you got your other metamorphic rocks that, if you're not here tomorrow or Wednesday, you won't see me show you, but you see around Holden here, including what the copper deposit was in. It come from the floor of an ocean somewhere else some time ago. And I guess that's my story for today.
Thank you.
Sure.
Is there still some uplifting going on in this area?
Yeah, the Cascades are still actually uplifting mountain range. One of the more rapidly uplifting mountain ranges in the world. You know, there's like the Himalayas are also in that class and so on. And it's a dynamic equilibrium. Uplift occurs at around the same rate as the erosion is occurring.
Yeah, kids throwing rocks off the mountains.
Yeah. Well, that's a component. Like I said, humans are in that part of the rock cycle where the erosion and sediments occur. So we make our contribution. But yeah, if you look at a mountain range and it looks this jagged, even if it wasn't glaciated, although they get this tall, most mountains would be glaciated at some point, chances are it's still an actively uplifting mountain range. Mm-hmm. The Appalachian Mountains are just about done. It takes a long time. Mountain ranges are a long, slow process. The Appalachians finished most of their plutonic and igneous and metamorphic activity over 100 million years ago, but they're still finishing their uplift and erosion. The erosion is catching up, and the uplift is at a very low rate now of the Appalachians, so that's why they're low and rounded. Mm-hmm. But if the Cascades were to, if the subduction, it's not gonna, but if the subduction could be turned off today, then based on what we see in the Appalachians, it could take on the order of 100 million years before it gets turned into a bunch of low hills here. It's a slow process, because so much heat and new molten magma has come in, it takes a long time for the Earth to